And then it occurred to me, what luck.
Okay.
I swore a solemn vow.
Years ago, I was invited to a party.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Exfabula.
Yay, Exfabula. Welcome back. My name is Leah Delaney, and I'm sitting here with...
I am Scotty Lee Myers.
And of course,
behind the scenes is Eric, our sound guy.
Our super secret silent sound engineer. Yes. Hi, Eric. Settle down. Yay. Well, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Exfabula podcast. If you're not familiar with us, we hold storytelling events in Milwaukee with the main purpose of building community here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And today's going to be a special sort of podcast or a spodcast or spudcast. We're going to feature stories from All Stars event of last year because, do you know why, Scotty?
Well, I believe our All Stars event is coming up in May.
Yeah, May 9th.
So it's
actually
a little teaser.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little bit of teaser. Yeah. Hey, a quiz question for you.
Yeah.
So did you know that this is our fifth season?
I did not know that. Fifth already.
Yes, number five. So how many All-Stars have we had?
We'll carry the one. Five, right?
Yes, exactly. You're sharp as a tack. Wonderful. We're all on the same page here. And this year, the theme for the All-Stars is Motherlode. And the thing about the All-Stars is that we have taken the audience favorites from our whole season and we put them up on stage and we have them tell a longer story because usually they're 5 minute long stories. Right. And now we're going to have them tell 10 minute stories. It's a little bit of a challenge, but it's under a different theme. And like I said, this theme is Motherlode.
That's right. Yeah. So they're not telling the same story that they won with during the season.
Sharp. You're still sharp.
That's what they're doing. So you're not going to hear a repetitive story. This is a whole new theme. Yes, these are our favorite storytellers throughout the season, but they're going to have a different theme and they're going to be doing it for 10 minutes. So they're really able to get in depth and the style and the way of storytelling changes a little bit. Mm-hmm. So on May 9th, we're going to have the Motherlode of the city's best storytellers.
Oh, you are such a shining
star. You see what I did that there?
Yeah. So, do you have any Motherlode stories?
Top of my head, I'm scratching my head here. I don't have one that immediately comes to mind. I understand that you do, though. You have a little bit of a Motherlode story.
Yes, for you audience, we might have discussed this prior to recording. So, yeah, I do. I have a Motherlode of mother stories. And it's not necessarily having to do with anything with mothers. I mean, people are going to have just a litany of different interpretations on that theme.
Right.
But mine is actually directly related to my mom and... to this day, I still can't live this down, actually. But when I was maybe 5th grade, 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, I really wanted glasses. And back then, the wireframes were really in. So, like, think of, like, Color Me Bad, like, you know, big hammer pants and, you know, polka dots and all that. I was hanging out at dance clubs. And I wanted those wire-rimmed glasses like nobody's business. So I got my eyes checked, and I thought...
Did you have to fake your test?
Well, I thought if I just said the E looked like an F, I would have such a low prescription that it wouldn't bother my eyes, and I'd get away. So A, I get my glasses, and then B, I will look hot as shit. So I did this, and of course, it all went pear-shaped very quickly because I got the glasses, and I looked good, but they were still too strong. I couldn't see how good I looked in the mirror because they were just too tough. So years later, I had told my mom that those glasses were a big joke. Sorry. And, you know, we weren't rich by any stretch of the imagination. That was $80 down the toilet just for my own vanity. And like I said, to this day, she holds a little anger about that. So I feel like I owe her $80 at this point.
That's really funny. That's a foolproof plan right there.
Yeah. Ooh, nicely done. We're going to whip up all the themes from this past event. That's actually a really good challenge. Because guess what? That would be really off the hook if you did that.
Oh, no, you didn't.
How many more do we have?
I'm not going to be able to top that.
Yeah. I don't even remember all of them. We started in October, right? Yeah. Silent Eric is miming with his hands right now. I think he knows all of them. Well, okay, so last year's All-Stars was Lost in Translation, which is a really cool theme to play with. And we actually started out that event in 2013. We started out with 2012's winner. That's how we kicked off the show. His name is Carl First, and I am going to be very happy to share with you, the audience, Carl First's story based on Lost in Translation.
All right, let's give it a listen.
All right.
So I'll just tell you, growing up, I always had a really small group of friends. And in the middle of that group, there was always my buddy Steve, who lived right down the street, and this kid Finch, who always wore soccer shoes but never played soccer. And I was grateful to have this handful of friends, but I was always unhappy in some way because I had this desire to be really popular with everybody, and the stupid idea that the only way to do that would be to constantly try as hard as I possibly could. And I'll give an example of how this usually played out. We got these seventh grade yearbooks, and I was looking at mine while it was still new, and I remember sitting there at my desk thinking, I'm going to fill every blank space in this thing up with signatures from the coolest kids in school. And it wasn't because I wanted to be friends with them. I didn't. It was because I wanted proof that I had been friends with them. I had this very vivid fantasy of taking this book out of a drawer and like blowing the dust off it and sitting around with my kids and watching the joy just bloom on their faces as they realized how universally loved I was at the age of 12. And kids could sense the fakeness in that, the kids I grew up with, they could, and they picked on me for it. You know, that's why that yearbook never made it past lunch period. A little blonde girl named Katie stole it and scratched out all my saves next summers or see next summers or whatever, and wrote in unflattering descriptions of my genitals. The help that I needed to break out of that desperate phase came when my brother gave me Black Sabbath's Paranoid album for my eighth grade graduation. And I didn't know who Black Sabbath was, but the cover art had me. It's got this like blurry photograph of this guy bounding through the woods. He's wearing, looks like homemade pajamas, and he's got a sword, a shield, and a helmet. You know, that spoke to me. And I popped that in my Walkman and real late at night, and I got four songs deep into that album until I woke my parents up, and they came into my room, and they found me standing on my dresser, gripping the dresser, and I'm in my tidy whities, and I'm pounding my feet involuntarily, and there's tears coming down my eyes. I was hooked. I was in. I mean, it had me. You know, by the time freshman year of high school started, Steve and Finch and I, we chained our wallets. We sort of drifted into school, met up whenever we could to talk about music, and drifted out. It was like we had joined a cloister of heavy metal monks. You know, nobody knew we were there. And if switching from trying as hard as I possibly could to be popular to not trying at all wasn't the healthiest move for a lad like myself, you know, I loved the results. You know, that pressure was gone, and I felt more like a real person, and it got even better when Steve got a job that lasted a couple of weeks, and it gave him enough money to get a used guitar, and Finch turned in these jugs of change for a bass, and I went to Radio Shack and got the cheapest amp they would sell me, and we had a band. Metal band, you know, we would call ourselves Wormwood, and we had no idea how to make music or like organize sound into patterns, you know, like that was, but we loved to practice, and every time we practiced, we would pretend we were playing for a huge crowd, and you know, Steven and Finch would just be in a lather, just rabbing, busting into each other and breaking shit, and like I had this long green woman's coat that I would kind of strut around in, you know, and like it. And scream, and we knew we weren't good, ladies and gentlemen. We weren't delusional, but none of us really understood how profoundly bad we were because we started inviting people to these freaking things. You know, we started having them over, and we had access to alcohol, and so that was a big boost for attendance. And so it wasn't uncommon on a Friday night for there to be as many as four individuals, you know, tolerating what we did for beer, you know, and it was great. And we're doing one of these concerts, and you know we're playing our hearts out. You know, Steve and Finch are like, dar, 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 and I'm like, dar, dar, dar. You know, we're doing our thing, and I grab a crowbar, and I'm gonna hit it on the concrete for sparks for effect. You know, and I grab this thing, I do a big crowbar swing. You know, and hit myself right in the foot, and I was wearing boots, so it was okay, but it made this like menacing thud, and then there was a scream, And before I looked up, I had thoughts. I had two thoughts. I thought, oh my God, there's a girl here. And then I thought, I think I have a crush on this girl because she's paying attention to me. And I looked up and there was a girl there. It was Katie, the girl that defaced my yearbook 3 years before. And she had gone through some changes too. She had on these really tall, sparkly plastic boots over her blue jeans, and she was wearing an army jacket with band patches on it, and she had a crew cut, and I thought she was just about the most sophisticated and beautiful person I'd ever seen. And I, of course, didn't talk to her because I was scared, but, you know, like a week later, there's a note from her in my locker, and then before you know it, we're sitting together at lunch, and I'm going to Katie's house after school, and she was an artist, so she would draw this stuff, and I would look at her legs, and then we'd go to the spring-fed pond by our house. We ditched school for that, and we never even held hands, but if I could force myself not to think about it, which was easy to do, I could imagine she was my girlfriend. And then there I was, you know, fake girlfriend, shitty band. Like, 14-year-old me, cloud nine. Like, everything's going great. And Wormwood's doing these shows, and one of the guys who was a regular at these shows is this dude Dave, who's like a good musician, and he took us under his wing and showed us how to play our instruments, and he started playing drums for us, and then he set up this concert for us at our high school. Like, you know, we were gonna play, like another band was playing, and while they were taking a break, we were gonna play two songs, and whoa, you know, like it's crazy, and we're getting ready for this, and I'm so infatuated with everything that's going on in my life that I'm like totally blind to the direction that my friendship with Katie is going in. And that's a shame because it's not going in a good direction at all. She's doing things like coming to my house at 3 a.m. barefoot to ask for a cigarette. Or she used to draw these really psychedelic sunsets that were pretty, and then she switched to charcoal portraits of Hitler. And the notes that she's given me are like longer and longer and harder to understand. But instead of discussing these things with her, I'm taking these notes and I'm poring over them, looking for secret messages about how she has a crush on me, you know? And so I was genuinely surprised when she wasn't in school for a couple days. And then she called me, and what happened was she had tried to burn down her family's house. And her parents had committed her to the mental ward. And so I went to go visit her. I had my mom park me across the street from the hospital because I was embarrassed to be seeing my parents in a mental ward. And I take the elevator up, and I go through a little cage, and you know all the kids are there. Katie's there. They're all wearing banana yellow sweatsuits with no strings, and she kind of gives me a tour, and we joke around, and we play cards, and you know, maybe a half hour later, I'm leaving, and a nurse pulls me aside, and she says, "Carl, you know, you're coming back, right?" I'm like, "I'm coming back tomorrow, you know." And she says, "You are Katie's guardian angel. She needs you, and she always talks to you about you like that, and she gets so much strength from your relationship, and you're really gonna help her recover if you just support her." And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, I'm a guardian angel. All my suspicions are confirmed, you know, like I feel great, and now I know when she gets out, I got a girlfriend, you know." So I'm visiting her all the time, and in the meantime, we're getting ready for our show, and the Wormwood show rolls around. I get on stage. There's about 30 kids at the high school. We're all getting ready, and there's, you know, all of them have their backs to us except for one, and I get up there and way too close to the mic, you know, and I say, I'm wearing an AC/DC shirt, and I'm like, "Who's ready for AC/DC show next week?" And this big goth kid in the back yells, "AC/DC sucks!" And then we just kick it, you know, like, it was that's how we rolled. And we're playing our first song, and in the middle of our first song, my job was to jump into the crowd and start a mosh pit, which is my job tonight, by the way. But my job was to get in there and knock kids around, and so I do it, and I'm knocking, we're hitting each other, we're having a good time, you know, and suddenly someone picks me up by the back of my collar, like gets me off my feet, and I'm thinking, this freaking goth kid's coming after me, you know, so I give him a good elbow to back him off, you know, like I've been around the block, and, you know, one of those. I'm on the floor, and I'm getting dragged out of the gym, because it wasn't the goth kid, it was a cop, and he gets me in the hallway with the deans, and they're yelling at me because they're like, "Well, you're such an idiot," and I'm contrite. I'm like, "Oh, no, you know, I'm so sorry." And I keep looking at the cop, and I'm like, "I thought you were a goth kid. I'm so sorry. I thought you were some kind of goth kid." And that mantra had some unintended consequences, because I could tell after a while that the police officer, he's definitely trying not to laugh, you know? Like, And the deans are kind of in the same mood, and they're like, Carl, don't start any more mosh pits at school. And I'm like, I will never start mosh pits at school anymore, you know. And they're like, go play your song. So I go back in there, and I get on stage, and the kids thought that I had, like, rock-starred my way out of it. So they're like, ah. And we played our second song. It was a Black Sabbath song. It felt great. I felt so relieved I wasn't going to jail, you know. And I felt 9 feet tall to be playing these tunes. And then about a week later, Katie got released, and I'm ready, you know. And she immediately started a very serious relationship with our drummer, Dave.
So that was Carl Furst with his Lost in Translation story. He was the winner of 2012, and we opened up with his All-Star story in 2013. And holy cats, was he living with some bad company.
Hey! And what a bonus to have a girlfriend, a fake girlfriend, and a metal band.
Oh, yeah. Talk about the close encounters with all the moshing going on over there. Oh. What? Did I do that? Oh, so many things. So many themes, so little time. Oh, trust me. There's only so much time we got here, right?
We should probably clue in listeners that what we're referencing here, what we're forcing down your throats, are themes of previous story slams throughout this season.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's completely off the record, though.
Yeah, of course.
Boom. Okay, we hit all of them. Yay!
Nice work.
Can you put in some like little clapter here?
Yeah, we'll put in applause.
Clapter, which is like clapping and laughter.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, well, let's close the event with the winner of 2013's All-Stars event. This was Dave Hendrickson.
And this is a very different style of telling a story, right? This is more of a Garrison Keillor. Dave's very much quiet and slow, and but very in-depth and intriguing, but much different than the pacing that we saw from Carl's story. And
yeah.
It's a touching story.
It is. It really is.
Yeah, well, about lost in the theme, Lost in Translation. So here's Dave's story. Let's give it a listen.
Okie doke.
Thank you. On my 13th birthday, my dad presented me with a Savage single-shot 22 caliber rifle. And he did it in a sort of ceremonious way. And I received it in the same spirit. He didn't say anything, but he looked me in the eye, and he got this little grin on his face that said, "You and I both understand the significance of this moment." Well, I did, because all through my childhood, my dad had given me special presents. Hockey skates, jackknife, hammer and saw, because he was a carpenter, bicycle, bow and arrow, BB gun. And every one of the gifts came with this unspoken message: "This gift is for a boy who is not going to grow up to be a cream puff." Now, Dad's definition of a cream puff was any male who would willingly wear a necktie without complaining, worked in an office, and golfed. This covered almost all of my mother's male relatives. See, Dad, I had a wary attitude towards my mother's family, because when I was quite young, my mother passed away, and he wouldn't have been able to raise me by himself. So it was decided I would live with two of her aunts. If anybody could turn me into a cream puff, it would be those two doting, affectionate great aunts of mine. Dad just, he never was comfortable with that arrangement, but all he ever said about it was, "Oh, I don't go in for that mushy stuff." Well, I did. Nevertheless, we did have things in common. We both liked to read, we both liked to laugh, and my dad loved to tell stories, and I loved to listen to his stories. Like the time when he was younger, he was in a brawl, and he accidentally decked the county sheriff. And then another time, he was deer hunting, And he was in a clearing. And this big doe just came out of the woods and stood and looked there staring at him. And he said, I looked into that doe's brown eyes, and I could not raise my rifle. So he said, shoo. And the doe ran away. And then Dad would laugh, laughing at himself. And then there was the time when none of my mother's relatives had ever swam the 2-mile length of Cedar Lake the way Dad had when he was younger. Well, we like to watch the Jackie Gleason show on Saturday nights. And the June Taylor dancers always open the show. Now, they were sexy, young women who were not overwhelmed with too many clothes. I could never quite figure out my dad, you know, like with his stories. You couldn't tell. You weren't sure if they were 100% true or maybe half true or just complete fabrications, because he was a very frustrated entertainer living in a small town where he had no stage to perform on. But anyway, when the music started for the Jackie Gleason show, for the June Taylor dancers to come out, Dad would jump out of his chair, go into the kitchen to get a cup of coffee. Only he wouldn't come back. I would join him there in the kitchen, reluctantly, and we'd stand there and make small talk, like two guys waiting for a bus. And then, as soon as the music stopped, that was the all clear. It was now safe for us to go back into the living room. On the Saturdays, the daytime, we took my rifle and we went out to the local dump and we took turns shooting at tin cans and glass bottles. And this went on for months. I got pretty good. I was a good shot, and I also got to just like that feeling of gently squeezing the trigger and then suddenly seeing a glass bottle just shatter into pieces. So one day, my dad said to me, he said, you know, maybe we ought to go squirrel hunting someday. And I said, yeah, sure, Dad. In a way that meant anything but, yeah, sure, Dad. Because, see, I never told him, but I had never killed a snake or a bird or a turtle or anything in my life. And I kind of think he knew that. So we kept on going out to the dump, shooting there. And then one day, we didn't go to the dump. He turned north. And I looked at him, and we were going towards Cedar Lake. I looked at him. And he spoke to the windshield and said, thought we ought to go squirrel hunting today. Well, what had been a beautiful autumn day suddenly wasn't so beautiful to me. We got there. I followed him into the woods. I kept my eyes on the ground because that would greatly increase my chances of never seeing a squirrel. Unfortunately, he didn't, and he stopped me, and he put his hand on my shoulder. He pointed up to a tree, and there was a squirrel. Well, I just prayed the thing would run away, but it didn't. And then I thought, I could purposely miss, but Dad is going to know, because he knows I'm a good shot. He's going to know I did this on purpose. So I aimed at the squirrel. And, you know, at that point, I wanted to say, Dad, I don't want to do this. But you can't do that, not when your dad's hopes and dreams for you are riding on it. So my finger tightened on the trigger. I don't know how long I stood there, motionless. And the squirrel was motionless, too, except just its tail would twitch once in a while, like it knew something was up. and I'm gently squeezing the trigger just ever so slightly, about to blast that little squirrel into oblivion, when Dad suddenly said, "Oh, that one's kind of small." I lowered the rifle slowly. I was in a minor state of shock and a major state of relief. I watched the squirrel disappear into the trees. Dad was already halfway to the car. We drove back to town in silence. When we got to the intersection, he didn't turn towards town. He turned out towards the dump. And this time he did look at me, and he got that little grin on his face. And he says, "I thought we'd go out and do a little target shooting." Well, we did for several hours. And that night, the June Taylor Dancers opened for Jackie Gleason, and when the music started up, Dad bolted for the kitchen, as usual. Only this time, I didn't follow him, partly because I was afraid of what he might say about my poor performance that day, and partly because I thought it was about time I get a good look at all those pretty women on the TV set. Well, the rifle went in a closet, and we never went shooting again. And it didn't come up until years later. I was grown, had a son of my own, and Dad called. And he said, "I sold your rifle for $10. I hope you don't mind." Nah, I didn't mind. I've thought about that day often over all these years, and about me and Dad and the squirrel and the rifle. And, you know, we never spoke about it because something so profound and so deep had passed between us that we had no need of language. It was as though nothing was lost in translation. Because on that day, my dad gave me the best gift he ever could have given me. Out of the goodness of his heart, on that day, my dad gave me permission to be myself. Thank you.
So that was Dave Hendrickson. He was the winner of 2013's All-Stars event.
Who will be the winner this year?
Dun, dun, dun. Big question mark, question marks. I don't know. I really don't have any sort of guess. Any, you know, I'm always surprised, actually. It could be anybody. It really could.
Yeah, there's a dark horse out there.
There's a dark horse. You're just going to ride up on the stage of Turner Hall Ballroom and surprise everybody.
And that's going to be Friday, May 9th at Turner Hall Ballroom. You can get tickets at papstheater.org.
You certainly can. And we recommend pre-sale. Definitely. Get those tickets while they're hot.
And it's just a beautiful atmosphere. I mean, the lights, and they got the candles and the lighting, the string of pearls sort of down through the ceiling. And it's just comfortable and cozy, and you're with the community. It's a great night. If you haven't been to an all-star event in the past, make sure you go next month.
Definitely. Yeah. Please, please come. Please come. It's an awesome event. And we'll actually be doing another podcast after that. We'll be sharing some other great stories, the winner of this particular event.
That's right.
Next month. Yep. And actually, this All-Stars event, we are going to be showcasing, and we're going to be selling our Season 6 memberships.
Yay!
Nice.
Which is great, because if you buy a membership, not only do you get like preferred seating and such, you also get discounts on the workshops, storytelling workshops that we're offering. We have Secret Fabula events where we actually go out into the community and we actually get stories from the people involved with certain businesses. And we really just bring out the stories from the community just through these interesting places we go to, whether they're businesses or landmarks and stuff. It's just members-only events. I mean, we're going to be busy up to our eardrums with stories.
Yeah. XFabio is beyond the stage. Stories are swapped everywhere, and we're there to listen and record and enjoy.
Yeah. And we hope you're enjoying yourselves, too, out there in Radio Land, because we are. All right. Well, do you have anything else to add?
I look forward to seeing everyone on May 9th.
Yes, me too. Be there, be square. It's going to be fun. Oh, and what's the theme again? I believe it's Motherlode.
It is.
Yep. All right. This sounds good. I'm excited. I hope you guys are too. We'll have you guys sitting around the old-timey radio next month for another episode of Exfabula Radio. Till then, I'm Leah Delaney.
And I'm Scotty Lee Myers.
Eric, shut up. Quiet. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll see you in May. And then it occurred to me, what luck.
Okay.
I swore a solemn vow.
Years ago, I was invited to a party.
But I never there was a band.
Irish Italian cat.